You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson on today's show.
Now is the time for Iraq's leaders to govern their nation with the same vision and sense of purpose that helped to bring this new government together in the first place.
Is Iraq's new unity government a milestone for the country? And what does it mean for the fight against Islamic State? Alessio Patilano and Roger Boys are here with me to discuss. And...
Oh, you'll take the high road and I'll take the low. I'll be in Scotland a-foreign.
With next week's referendum looming, we ask whether the prospect of an independent Scotland is finally making people pay attention. All that, plus we'll play you the best new music with Nick Luscombe, we'll enjoy an interview with a Stationery fan, and much more besides. That's Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, right now. So lots coming up in the next hour, but before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest world news.
Dutch experts investigating the downing of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17, which crashed in eastern Ukraine, say the plane was hit by numerous objects moving at high speed. The crash on the 17th of July killed 298 people, two-thirds of them from the Netherlands. The Dutch Safety Board, in its report released today, said it was not caused by a technical fault or by actions of the crew. The chairman of the Dutch Safety Board is Jibber Joestra.
There are elements there, and perhaps they have moved, but there are elements here. Interested in the cockpit is very important because a lot of those objects were penetrated the cockpit. There are some instruments we are interested in who can provide us with data that are not in the flight data recorders. So it is important, but we have to wait and see whether the situation will be secure.
Meanwhile, European Union defence ministers gathered in Milan today for an informal two-day meeting with the shaky truce between Russia and the Ukraine set to be high on the agenda. The EU adopted new sanctions against Russia over its involvement in the Ukraine war on Monday, but delayed enforcing them to leave time to assess whether a ceasefire in Ukraine is holding. The sanctions, which target the ability of Russia's top oil producers to raise capital in Europe, were originally due to take effect on Tuesday. The US Secretary of State John Kerry is about to arrive in the Middle East today for talks on building a coalition to stop the progress of Islamic State militants in Iraq. The news comes as the US welcomed the formation of a new Iraqi government as a major milestone. The new Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has included members of Iraq's Shiite majority and its Kurdish and Sunni minorities in his cabinet. Fawaz Jerjes is from the London School of Economics.
I think it's a first important step. I think if there is a major point one needs to make, it fills the political vacuum that has existed in Iraq for quite a while, and that's why the great hopes. But if you look carefully at the ministers and the ministries, are really all faces, the same faces.
Here in the UK, Scottish political leaders joined in Edinburgh on Tuesday to announce more powers for the Scottish Parliament should voters reject independence, while the British Prime Minister David Cameron visits Scotland on Wednesday and has called on Scots not to break up the United Kingdom. A surge in Scottish support for breaking away from the UK has made an independence referendum set for the 18th of September too close to call. And a new study is warning that the southwest part of the United States could face a decade-long drought. Researchers at Cornell, the University of Arizona, and the U.S. Geological Survey say that climate change is increasing the possibility of a mega drought, which could last for more than 30 years. Toby Ault is the report's lead author.
The risk of a decade-long drought is normally about 50%, but with climate change, it goes up to about 80 or 90%, according to our results. And for a multiple decade-long drought, a mega drought, the risk is normally in the order of 5 to 15%, but with climate change, it goes up to between 20 and 50% for a lot of the Southwest.
And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Jonathan will be back in a little under half an hour. In the meantime, though, you're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
The time here in London is 18.05, nearly 18.06. If you're listening in New York, it's 13.06. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio, I'm delighted to say Alessio Patalano, lecturer in war studies at King's College London, and Roger Boys, diplomatic editor at The Times. Welcome both gentlemen to the studio. We'll begin today with Iraq. The US Secretary of State John Kerry has hailed the formation of a unity government in Iraq as a milestone. The country's new prime minister has played as cleverly as he can to give the catastrophic state of his country a standing chance of taking on Islamic State. He's appointed a Sunni and a Kurd as his deputy prime minister, giving also an unspoken cue to the rest of the world that Iraq may yet be in a fit enough position to take on IS militarily. Well, let's begin with this announcement. Alessio, is this really a milestone for Iraq, as John Kerry has said?
Well, certainly politically, it was an important statement to have. So finally, we have this new unity government. This was something that many expected, many wanted, and the sort of statement that it was necessary to give signs of life, as it were, in Iraq. Then whether that will make a difference from a military point of view, I think that's still a question very much open. And, you know, there are different levels when we talk about military operations. It seems to me that one component of it, which is the cohesiveness, the ability of the Iraqi forces to take the battle on the ground, is very much an open question. So the extent to which the new political government will have sort of a spillover into the conduct of the operations and the ability to actually take the Islamic State under control still is a slightly different question and a very open one.
Roger, just listening to what Alessio was saying there, there seems to be two issues that need to be resolved quickly. First and foremost is a military issue with IS, Islamic State. Secondly is whether the unity government is indeed one, whether appointing a Sunni prime minister and a Kurdish prime minister will in fact create a unified Iraq.
Yes. Actually, it's not entirely new that there are Sunnis and Kurds in the government, but it's important that they're there. It's important to show that this is not the al-Maliki kind of regime. And apart from attacking IS, for which you need the legitimacy and, if you like, the fig leaf of a government that's coherent, you also want to keep the country together. And that's really the most important element of having the Kurds in the government. And it has to be more than that. Kurds have to be integrated into the security machine. They have to be, the army has to be responsive to Kurdish needs, because there's a real risk that the Kurds will at some stage break away. And the disintegration of modern Iraq is not the point of what the Americans want to do.
Roger just mentioned there the idea that it has to be shown that there is a unity government in existence, but then went on to sort of expose the more practical problems and focusing on the Kurdish issue. Hoshi Zebari, the deputy prime minister, former foreign minister, to what degree can he influence the Kurds, who effectively have been an absolute key player in keeping IS at bay?
I think Roger made a very important point that the practicalities of this have to be sorted out. You know, the Iraqi forces perform two different duties at this stage. One is effectively that of an armed police service that has to keep the country together with all its tribal, internal tribal division, etc., etc. The other one is an effective fighting force to mount what is the growing capabilities of the Islamic State. And I think in both functions, the Kurds have been left on sidelines, certainly insofar as the policing activity, the element of the internal security and cohesion of Iraq. So for the time being, what we don't know is the extent to which this current appointment will sort of filter through the ranks and then effectively create a situation by which the Iraq armed forces will integrate Kurds more into their machinery and therefore see this more as a cohesive structure that operates, first of all, to protect the Iraqi people as such, because at the moment what we haven't seen is like the different tribal structures are protecting themselves. So we haven't seen a country that is protecting itself from an external sort of localized threat. We're seeing different components and sort of groups, as it were, sort of try to pick up a fight and retain, sort of protect themselves. Then how the country then take this threat as a country militarily away, that's yet another question. As I said, at the moment, we don't really know too much how in practical terms of this political appointment will have an effect that will change the internal structure to address these two fundamental core functions that the Iraq Armed Forces are supposed to provide. One, the internal security and the cohesiveness of the country, and second, then take the fight to the Islamic State.
And as it stands, we still don't have a defence minister and an interior minister, two key roles which Alessio have just said are absolutely the thing that needs to be organised as quickly as possible. To what degree do we have a unity government when you don't have two such key figures?
Well, they'll come. I mean, we're on the brink of a war there, we're going to have one quite fast. What's important, though, is to watch Iran, to see how much Iran, how much influence Iran has over the choice of these extremely sensitive cabinet positions, whether it tries to sway things one way or another, as it did with Maliki. It's getting very complex, and it will get more complex over the next 10 days because Obama is committed, mainly for sort of psychological reasons, I suppose, to build a coalition of people who are opposed to ISIS. Well, that's a complete spread of countries, and Sunni countries and indeed Iran. So it's a question of who do you talk to? Who do you talk to? Who do you bring on board? And how then does this Iraq, the crisis within Iraq itself, reflect that? Are there going to be games with tribal groups? Will the Saudis want something in return for their participation or support of an armed mission? You know, it's incredibly complex. And between now and the UN General Assembly, we're going to have this period, a very intense period of horse trading and bargaining over the future of Iraq. And for a while, the Iraqi government, whatever signals it does send, will just be a bystander in this.
Roger just mentioned there, Alessio, this wholly international issue of Islamic State, the fact that nations are being brought, the whole world is being drawn into this conflict. And it is setting up situations, arguably, that the people who would be on paper an enemy politically are having to become a military ally.
Absolutely. I was about to touch on this point because it seems to me that whatever else we can say about this new unity government, one of the fundamental roles that it's supposed to play right now in this small window is to allow Secretary of State Kerry to go around and say, well, the fight against ISIS is something that should unite almost everyone on the planet. That's what he was saying. I think it's an important statement in the sense that he's trying to make a point that no matter what your contribution is, no matter what our sort of broader political divides are, this is something that we cannot sort of keep it on the sidelines. We have to put on the sides our differences and try to face this, which could be a serious threat, not just to Iraq the way the sort of the United States envisaged it many years ago when they all started sort of the toppling of Saddam Hussein, but it's what Iraq is today and what this problem will be if we don't address it for Iraq and the rest of the region. And by the way, the rest of the region, that means not only the Gulf states and sort of Iran and other bits and pieces, but also for the Europeans, you know, across the pond, the Mediterranean. And so they're trying to build up that sort of this. It's interesting that they talk about coalition, but this is really not the coalition picture, at least in this political sense, of the one that we got in 2001, shortly after 9/11. It's a very different concept. It seems at least that it's been articulated in a different way. It was very interesting that Kerry was saying, we will accept any type of contribution, and we accept that some countries will provide sort of muscle, others will provide with intelligence and whatever other type of support, because this is something that has different
different layers, and we're very happy to accept a contribution for every single one of those.
It sounds very much, therefore, Alessio, that you need a driving force in this. Roger, who takes the lead in this? I mean, there have been suggestions that the best way and the ideal situation in Iraq would be an operation comparable to Libya a couple of years ago, where you have a coherent ground local army, the Iraqis, supported from the air by the United States. But Alessio has just painted a picture that actually effectively the United States is wanting to be in the driving seat for this.
Well, first of all, I certainly wouldn't use Libya as a model for any kind of operation.
No, but in getting rid of Gaddafi, it worked. I mean, what happened afterwards is a completely different matter.
Yeah. I mean, yes, America has to be in the driving seat. I don't think there's any doubt about it. I can't imagine any other way of doing this. But what it does mean, my feeling is it'll be the defining moment for Obama, Obama's second term. And he's got to confront, for example, how America stands towards the Syrian civil war. You know, it's been going on for 40 months and he hasn't actually had a position. All that's happened is that, you know, some binoculars and night sights have gone to moderate rebels. And there's been a bit of training here and there, but nothing's happened. And now we have a situation where ISIS might shift from Iraq to safe havens in Syria, and he's going to have to make a decision. But only he can make that decision. And it's a really big moment for Obama, it seems to me. His brand has been withdrawing from wars and ending the era of perpetual warfare, as he would call it. And now he's back in Iraq. And he's going to be back in Iraq in quite a big way. And he has to be, of course. The coalition doesn't have any coherence at all whatsoever without America in a leadership role. But he finds leadership difficult. You know, he couldn't lead a dog to a butcher's shop, quite frankly, Obama.
We turn now to the sanctions agreed by the EU to be imposed on Russia. They'd target even more tightly those businesses and individuals close to Vladimir Putin. But with a ceasefire holding in eastern Ukraine, albeit shakily, the EU has decided not to impose them just yet. To discuss this, I'm joined by Alessio Patilano and Roger Boys. Alessio, we've just heard there about Roger saying that Obama lacks leadership. One person who surely doesn't lack leadership is Vladimir Putin. This is an absolute masterstroke. A stroke on his part, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think, you know, it makes, if you're a university, it makes for a perfect case how to teach things in an old-fashioned way. You know, that's the good guys, bad guys, master diplomats, master sort of tacticians. And Putin ticks so many boxes. Plus, he looks also old-fashioned, you know, with his sort of chest pumping, you know, going around half naked, showing that he's got muscles and other bits and pieces. So in that respect, the man is just a work of art. If it didn't exist, someone should have just think it up. Because it's just beautiful. Make a perfect villain in any type of story. That being said, though, I think he's been extremely clever and I think this entire story will stay with us, the whole situation in Ukraine for quite some time. But I think what is extremely interesting, and as an East Asian specialist, I am always tempted to connect what is happening in Ukraine and happened in Crimea with some of the behavior that the Chinese have in some of their own security issues, whether this is South China Sea or East China Sea. The cleverness to identify grey areas in whatever international regimes that exist today that allows you then to smartly operate and pursue a policy line that favours your interests but puts in a very difficult position your opponent, which is the perfect definition of a winning strategy. Because what is happening right now is that the ability so far of Putin of presenting as if Russia did not exist in either Crimea or Ukraine is, we're not there. Really? Seriously? Us? No. And that's the same thing, for example, the way the Chinese look at international maritime law. You know, it's like exploiting the grey areas that put them in a situation like to present a narrative that is very coherent. And that's the key element. And I think what Putin brings with his persona and personal charisma, the ability to turn around and present a picture that on paper makes perfect sense. And you can't really turn around and say, like, no, you're a liar. And I think that's absolutely brilliant. That's something that has something really important under Martin.
Roger, how do the world's diplomats deal with this textbook villain?
Well, I do wish they would call him a liar. That would, you know, and it is quite extraordinary how much he's got away with since the Winter Olympics, I suppose. I mean, if you take every stage of this conflict, you know, snatching Crimea, you know, subverting Eastern Ukraine, shooting down an airliner, which I think we can fairly lay on his door, you know, invading the country by subterfuge, but nevertheless invading the country. And each stage of the way, we're following because we find that we don't have any kind of deterrent mechanism as a slightly outdated alliance, NATO alliance, against this kind of limited warfare. So he jabs, he pauses. He jabs, he pauses. I don't know whether that's a martial arts thing or whatever, but anyway, that's the way he goes. And now, of course, we have a ceasefire and a kind of pseudo peace negotiation going on, and that's a pause. Then sanctions come, but they're pseudo sanctions. I mean, that's to say they affect the oil business and not gas. So everybody is bluffing, counter-bluffing, and actually the only people who are really suffering are the people in Ukraine.
I mean, just building on that slightly, you talk about the pseudo-sanctions and how the alliance, how NATO has been found wanting. Was this perhaps a moment when the EU could actually show its teeth just a little and seems to be failing to do so?
Well, there's a terror of the winter. The winter is the moment when the balance of advantage shifts back to Putin in a big way because he can turn off, he can stop the pumps. And if it's a cold winter, then Ukraine's in trouble. And frankly, all the gas that's transiting to Western Europe becomes an issue too. So these sanctions quite explicitly do not mention gas. We're freezing them out of Western credit markets, making financing of their debt difficult. Inflation is growing. You know, capital flight is bad. But, you know, capital leaves Russia and it comes back. You know, so there's a theater of punishment. But the actual real crunch time is when the gas is turned off. And that's what we're waiting for, really. That's what we're waiting for. He wants to achieve as much as he can before this final showdown.
And if and when that happens, when the gas is turned off, will we see a further splintering within the EU, within Europe more widely, that we seem to be seeing at the moment? Finland, on the outskirts, is worried about any sanctions being imposed on Russia because of the direct effect. The Eastern European countries want sanctions, but at the same time are terrified. And then there's this little cluster of the wealthy West, the French, the Germans, the British, all saying, let's just not do anything too hastily, because they know full well that their investments are really, really a key issue here.
Yes, I think we're standing at a crossroads, because for many years now, and certainly this is the case for the way NATO has been deployed over the past decade or so, really, we've been talking about some fundamental principles. You know, NATO, after all, 9/11 was about principles, was about, you know, going after a concept. And when you hear, for example, high-ranking NATO commanders talking about the importance of the global commons and talking about space, cyber, maritime environment, sort of the maritime realm, as these fundamental ideas, as if they were part of this Article 5. Right? These are core ideas. These are big ideas, right? And I think what Putin and again, as I said, I wouldn't take some people in Beijing as well out of that equation, are doing is just testing the West against these principles. Right? So what exactly do you mean? Exploiting the borderlines. And I think for the time being, we haven't found a way to actually commit to anything because of the past 10, 15 years of Iraq and Afghanistan. So the question is, how over the next few months, the current standoff that is testing the very principle upon which we have been reshaping the foundations of security,
which require considerable capabilities. And we're not sure we're either willing or capable of getting that capability deployed on the ground. That test will be very important. And I think this is where all the differences will come out.
We're going to take a brief break now. When we return, we discuss the Scottish independence question.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Still with me, Alessio Patilano and Roger Boys. We turn now to next week's Scottish referendum on independence, a subject that until very, very recently only people in Scotland, one could argue, gave two hoots about. But an independent poll at the weekend put those in favour of splitting from the rest of the UK narrowly ahead. Cue a mad block booking of trains and planes from London to Edinburgh as the Westminster Mandarins realised that in less than 10 days' time, the United Kingdom could be looking for a new name and a new flag. Roger Boys, did we all wait? Wake up and pay attention on Sunday?
Yes. I mean, I think we all thought that the polls would narrow and that it would get quite close. But of course, you know, the English have this tendency to sort of blindfold themselves in this kind of situation, and they slept their way through it. I think it's going to become a real problem for England. I don't think it's a problem for Scotland. They would have liked a third option, of course. They would have liked, but then they should have said so in the beginning. The Scottish National Party should have said so in the beginning that they also wanted to vote on devolution when they were negotiating with Cameron. But the problem is going to be England, I think. The more we think about it, the more worried we're getting. And I think it reflects not just the fact that we're losing a bit of territory, usually sort of rainy territory with bad cuisine, but actually, for example, if Scotland ends up as Slovakia did, for example, when Slovakia broke up from Czechoslovakia, if it ends up, for example, imposing a flat tax, for example, Slovaks imposed a flat tax of 19%, then investment will just flush, you know, will flood up north. And the northeast of England will become a desert. All those car factories that have been investing in Sunderland and so on, they're going to think twice. And so the atomization of Britain, I think, is going to become a real problem for the English. I think the Scots will just, you know, muddle on. I think whatever happens, whether they vote yes or no, they're going to get devolved economic powers.
Alessio Patilano, listening to that, is this big turnaround or this big sort of jolt that has seemed to have been experienced at the weekend when everybody suddenly thought, goodness me, Scotland could go? And we've seen the likes of Mark Carney, we've seen saying that the currency devolution wouldn't work. Japan is telling people to get their investments out of the UK because the pound could plummet. Is this because the Scotland Yes campaign suddenly got very, very, very good? Or is it because, as Roger argues, the English, just weren't really taking it that seriously?
I think it's a mix of both. I mean, it's a combination of the two elements in the sense that I was reading in the newspapers that the last confrontations, public debates, just the independence side seemed to be just thoroughly better. But that also might be just because there wasn't too much of concern and thought given to it until very recently. I think it's a little bit, it looks odd, probably what is happening now, which is everybody is rushing to Scotland to make a point about how important, excuse me, how important it is to stay together. But I would say that I was away and during the summer, and when I was following sort of the reporting on the subject, it was relatively light and really is picking up speed only now when it seems to be a problem. So I think there was a combination of the two elements. The fact that the Yes campaign has invested so much into it, and the fact that nobody at the other end of the spectrum really gave it too much of a thought about how to address it. That being said, though, I still think that the most important question, which is the economic question, and Roger pointed out one element about the north part of England, but I think in broad speaking, in broad terms, also the financial and the banking systems will be heavily affected. And I'm not sure the extent to which main political party leaders actually investigated or brought the fight back to the Scottish Independence Party of the ramifications and repercussions of a breakup of the union, especially in banking and financial terms.
Yes, can I just interrupt? Yes, cool. I mean, what we've been obsessing about while Alessia has been abroad is UKIP. And frankly, ever since May, the European elections, UKIP, there's been no other subject apart from UKIP. That's to say, a national identity party that is warning everybody that the whole Britain is losing influence, shrinking, is being pushed to the margins of Europe and should get out of Europe. And this, in some strange way, has coloured the debate in Scotland, because you have Scottish National Party, which is actually ruled quite effectively, at least seen from the Scottish perspective, and is playing identity politics. And actually, in some ways, is the absolute opposite of UKIP, in the sense that it looks as if they would probably join, there would be a European Union. They would stay in Europe while England, as it heads towards a referendum, might leave Europe. But there's something going on. There's something going. First of all, it distracted us, and second, there is some kind of chemistry going on between the two countries.
Roger Boys and Alessia Patalano, gentlemen, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
Vanuit Londen, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ut London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We hear the latest Balkan news from Guy Delaunay, and we talk pens and pencils and Tippex too with a stationery fan called James Ward. But before we get started on all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the latest world news.
Thank you very much. Dutch experts investigating the downing of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17, which crashed in eastern Ukraine, say the plane was hit by numerous objects moving at high speed and that it was not caused by a technical fault or by actions of the crew. Meanwhile, European Union defence ministers gathering in Milan today for an informal two-day meeting, with the shaky truce between Russia and Ukraine set to be high on the agenda. The US Secretary of State John Kerry is about to arrive in the Middle East today for talks on building a coalition to stop the progress of Islamic State militants in Iraq. The news comes as the United States welcomed the formation of a new Iraqi government as a major milestone. And here in the UK, Scottish political leaders joined in Edinburgh today to announce more powers for the Scottish Parliament should voters reject independence. A surge in Scottish support for breaking away from the UK has made an independent referendum set for the 18th of September too close to call. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Jonathan will be back in a little under half an hour's time to bring us a full roundup of the news. In the meantime, though, you're with Midori House. This is Emma Nelson. In half an hour's time, Section D will be here, Monocle's Design Hour. So all that to look forward to. But first, it is time to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we speak to our man in Belgrade, Guy Delaunay, occasionally in this parish, so often in London, Mr. Delaunay. But the first subject that you wanted to talk about was your geographical location today and its uncertainty.
Indeed. This is where do we start with this, Emma? We're in Serbia, the capital, which is Belgrade, where I'm sitting at the moment. Serbia's prime minister has flown off to China for some high-level meetings. This is Aleksandar Vučić. But we're also going to get into here the whole sort of is Serbia in the east or in the west conundrum, which is sort of, if not highlighted by the fact of Aleksandar Vučić flying to Beijing and Tianjin, then at least it gives us an excuse to talk about it a bit. And I think, you know, let's start off with the simple stuff, if you don't mind, which is Aleksandar Vučić, Prime Minister of Serbia, heading for China, and what this all means.
And what does it all mean? I mean, you see, it gives you an opportunity to talk about Serbia's not just geographical, but spiritual, political, economic location. What is the general feeling where you are?
Well, I think what Serbia needs at the moment is help, love and money.
Don't we all, Guy?
Yes, indeed. And quite possibly not in that order. But Aleksandar Vučić has been meeting some Chinese businessmen in Tianjin. This is where the World Economic Forum is going to be having its meeting. And one of the things he's trying to do is get Chinese cash sorted out to sort out the Belgrade to Budapest railway, which if anybody who's listening has ever travelled on it will know how... it's one of those things, again, I often use this phrase in relation to things in Serbia. It has a patina, and it's not the kind of patina that looks flattering as it builds up over the years. It's entirely unflattering, and it moves at snail's pace, and it's one of the things which is stopping Serbia from moving forward. You can't move forward if your railway goes backwards, and it really does need better connections to the rest of Europe in order to get itself out of the economic mire in which it has found itself embroiled in recent years. But it's not just about China, of course, Emma. The big question everybody's asking is, where does Serbia stand in relation to Russia? These are two countries which have had long-standing ties. They're both Orthodox Christian. They both use Cyrillic script. They're both Slavic nations. And they always go on about these ties and how great they are. Of course, now Serbia has applied to join the European Union. Accession talks, negotiations are underway. Which way is Serbia jump? Is Serbia going to jump, or does it indeed have to jump?
A situation worthy of an Aesop fable, one would argue. Let us move on to a tragedy, a piece of news involving a mining disaster.
This was in Bosnia at a mine called Rospatoce, which is near the town of Zenica, and there was a minor earthquake. Extraordinary, really, in an area in which you have mines. There are often earthquakes in this particular area, not particularly large ones, but this one was large enough to trigger a gas explosion. The gas explosion caused a tunnel collapse in the mine. 34 miners were trapped underground, and everybody was advised that they were all okay. And then when the rescuers came to pull them all out, 5 miners were missing. And it was only at that point that people realised there'd been a loss of life.
This sounds like a tale from an era from decades ago, Guy. Why is the situation still thus in Serbia?
And indeed, decades ago at the Rospatoce mine in the 1980s, they had the worst mining disaster in Bosnian history when about 40 miners died in a tunnel collapse there. The problem is, of course, that Bosnia is in a sorry state. I mean, talking about Serbia, I don't wish this to turn into a riff, but it is a fact that the infrastructure in the countries of this region, by and large, has been neglected over the years, and very important things like mines have not been invested in to the degree that they might have been. And of course, people are now asking questions about safety, large questions, because this was the third explosion at this particular mine in this year so far. And now we've had people die. It's obviously concentrating minds on what needs to be done. But you can't really just close these things. Bosnia is relying on the coal from Rospatoce mine to fire its power stations. And of course, it's an important economic driver as well for a region where a lot of people are unemployed.
Finally, Guy, we are not wont at Monocle to enjoy and exploit celebrity that much, but you have a tale not of a celebrity, but someone engaged more likely in infamy.
Diego Maradona,
of course.
The Argentinian football legend, much loved from Bangladesh to Bosnia and all over the
Is
Balkans.
He still loved, Guy?
maybe not so much loved in Dubrovnik, because in that Croatian coastal town, shaky camera phone footage has emerged of Diego indulging in a bit of big market style action where he's being held back by his friends while he chucks a glass at somebody to whom he has taken exception in some sort of after hours argy-bargy. So it's Diego Maradona in a little bit of controversy just for a change.
What was he supposed to be doing there?
Actually, do you know what? I don't know. Diego sort of I've been concentrating so much on the aggro that I haven't really looked into what Diego was actually doing in Dubrovnik, other than drinking and getting involved in fisticuffs outside nightclubs.
And is he going to feel the firm hand of the law, as he felt the firm hand of God a few decades ago?
And the great thing is the Croatian police have said no complaint has been made, therefore there are no charges to answer.
A gentleman made of Teflon, one would argue. Guy Delorne in Belgrade, thank you very much indeed. Up next, we examine a love of which many of us dare not speak. We meet a man who's written a whole book about stationery. I tremble. Stay tuned to find out more in just a moment.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
...1940 if you're listening in Paris, 1840 here in London. Welcome back to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Now, for those who no longer have a pencil case, who don't care which pen they use to sign a big contract with, or who get a small thrill when they crack open the spine of an exercise book as its pages laid bare with promise, this next item is not for you. For those of us whose best childhood Christmas presents was a voucher to spend on pencils, rubber, rulers and erasers, then my next guest may be just about to transport you Proust-like to a bygone era of bliss. James Ward has written a book about stationery, and he's brought it in and to tell us about it today. James, a very warm welcome to the programme. You're speaking to a convert, as may well become apparent in the next few moments. I adored stationery. You clearly do as well. What is it about it that gets us so hooked?
Well, I think there's a couple of things, really. There is this sort of nostalgia element, which I think you're sort of referring to, of memories of school days, sort of back to school period. But there's also this kind of, I think in stationery, there's this kind of potential. When you walk into a stationery shop, you're surrounded by all of these things that could kind of change your life. There's the notebook that you could use to write the novel that you've always wanted to. There's the post-it notes that are going to help you get organized, and the highlighters that mean you're going to pass that exam. There's the files that mean you're going to finally sort out all of your paperwork. There's all of this kind of potential in stationery, but there's also sort of even beyond that is this, it's a way of sort of procrastinating, because you can put off all of those things because you think, well, I've bought the notebook now, so I'm like halfway there.
I've done writing.
So I can take the rest of the day off now.
I think I lived that. Your book, I'm going to ask you about how you chose the typeface and the way that it feels, because it's one of those things. The front cover has a velvety smoothness to it, the likes of which I have not experienced on a book cover before. And it made me think, actually, it is the physicality of stationery, the way that paper feels, the way that a pen feels. To what degree did that influence the way that you decided to make the book?
That was a sort of really important concern. That exactly, you're right. It is all about sort of the joy of tangible objects. We're so used to tapping things on screens and using tablets and smartphones that actually holding something physical in your hand is becoming less and less important in our daily lives. So it was really, really important that the book felt and looked beautiful. In terms of sort of the design, as soon as that was the first design that I saw, and as soon as I saw it, I was immediately just like, yes, that's perfect. Don't change a thing.
So just looking at the way that you've approached your subject, it is, when I was reading it, it sort of struck me as bringing two elements to it. Firstly, you address each item. For example, a pot of Tippex with a forensic nature. The story of the Bic Biro, two names brought together as one. But also, you describe your subject matter. I think I'm referring to is it the paper organiser, the life organiser that you bring home in your first chapter? You unwrap it with the and you write about it with the anticipation, almost as if you're undressing a lover here. I mean, to what degree is this? Did you feel yourself getting a little bit too involved with your pens and pencils?
I think stationery people do have a very personal relationship with it. It's something that you hold in your hand. You have a physical sort of reaction to it. So it's impossible to not sort of be personal when you're talking about it. But at the same time, I did sort of want to cover, I mean, there hasn't really, as far as I could find, there isn't really a book about the history of stationery. That's kind of what prompted me to write it, is because I was looking sort of on Amazon one day thinking, you know, I'd really like to read a book about stationery, but there isn't one. So like someone has to write it. And I guess, I mean, the downside to that is that I'm the person who wanted to read it. And now I'm the one person who can't read that book in the same way that anyone else can. So I'm just going to.
Tell us which subjects that you approached. I mean, you tackle the big ones. You tackle BIC, you tackle Tippex, you tackle the highlighter. How did you organise the book, and what did you decide to include and leave out? Because you know, there are infinite varieties of stationery.
Yeah, that was always sort of quite difficult. Is there's no real strict definition of what qualifies as stationery, what is and what isn't, and so. There were sort of judgment calls. Sometimes there were things that I wanted to write about that I had to leave out, either because just in terms of space, or there wasn't really a way to weigh into writing about it that sort of didn't sort of distract from like the main narrative of that chapter. So I tried to find things where there's a sort of story to tell that maybe sort of reflects something a bit wider than just that pen itself.
And just looking at the way that we now buy our stationery, we bulk buy on the internet, which is a dreadful, dreadful thing. And there are, I suppose, in certain countries, I think Germany and France still have these sort of sacred stationery shops. That is something that it seems to be, it's a kind of area of retail that just seems to be a big mess at the moment, especially on the British high streets. You get very badly organised shops that don't know what they're selling, that don't know how to market, that don't know how to lay out their shops. Do you think that is taking away the pleasure of buying stationery?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, now probably most people buy their, if they even buy pens at all, rather than just sort of stealing them from work or whatever, then they'd probably just go to the supermarket and they'll buy a packet of whatever's on offer. But there are shops out there, sort of independent retailers that are doing stuff which is very, very special. There's a shop called Present and Correct, for instance, sort of near Sadler's Wells, which is absolutely beautiful. When you go in there, it's a beautiful shop. Their website's fantastic. I'm not paid by them. it's not a sort of product placement sort of sponsor. But yeah, I think there are ways that you can try and bring back that sort of that pleasure.
Nonetheless, and briefly, if you wouldn't mind, you are worried that the brands that we enjoy today are on their way out.
There is this sense that sort of companies seem to be just merging together and being swallowed up by bigger and bigger sort of conglomerates. So everything sort of seems to be merging together into some. One day, there's no doubt will be just some giant super stationery brand that swallowed everything else. And that, I think, is a shame. You sort of, when you look back, I mean, that was kind of what prompted the book, was the discovery of this Velos 1377 revolving desk tidy, and the fact that that I'd never heard of Velos. And like, I sort of buy quite a lot of stationery. I'd never heard of them. And the reason that I'd never heard of them is because they've been swallowed up by some other company. And so that name doesn't exist. And it was like this sense that this was something that used to be familiar to everyone, and now it's disappeared. So it's this kind of sense of loss of... I guess it's part of our like social history, really.
James Ward, author of Adventures in Stationery, out now. Thank you very much indeed for joining me in the
studio.
Thank you
for having me.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We turn our ears now to music. Monocle's Paul Noble spoke to our new colleague Nick Luscombe earlier today before the launch of his weekly music show, Monocle Presents.
It's Tuesday, which means it's time for the music review, and I'm joined by Nick Luscombe once again, host of Monocle Presents. Nick Luscombe.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good.
I'm still recovering from Kate Bush, by the way. I don't know if you've managed to get there.
Didn't get a ticket. No, I missed that again.
Should have pulled in some of your industry contacts.
Yeah. Was it good?
It was spectacular. But I've talked about that elsewhere on other programmes and to everyone in the building. So let's dig into your four picks of the day. What do we have?
Okay, so we're starting off with this great piece of music. I think fully inspired by the Mario Kart sort of video game, I think. Ryan Hemsworth, maker of great, quite beautiful electronic music, but he's surpassed himself with this one. Cream Soda is the name of it.
Considering that comes from Nova Scotia, that's the most Japanese thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it?
It's very playful and cute and blinky blonky.
Yeah, it's quite unlike most sort of cool electronic music around at the moment. It's really melodic and it is, yeah, totally inspired by video gaming, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, I love it. It's really addictive. And that's free on his SoundCloud site as well.
That's very nice. Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Can't argue with that.
No,
free.
Good value.
What's next?
Next up, Flying Lotus had to play this. It's a big release, obviously, with Kendrick Lamar as well. He's incredible, really, isn't he? Kind of keeps making great records. There's no stopping him.
Yeah.
I think.
I mean, for those that may not have heard of him, he's a sort of super influential producer from LA.
Yeah.
Which has never been known for its great electronic music. It's a bit of a wilderness in the American music scene.
Mm.
And he's built this whole scene of sort of very forward-thinking and ambitious electronic stuff, and just seems to be, you know, Tom York from Radiohead is all over him.
Yeah,
he's playing at some huge festivals, and this is his, you know, probably the most high-profile release.
Yeah, he's done, I think so, definitely. And he's really driving it, isn't he? And there are things like Dub Lab, which were doing a great job in LA, but I think as an individual, he's really charismatic as well, and he's really taken it to a popular level. So he's really affecting a lot of pop music, I think, as well.
So this is the album you'll be hearing on adverts and slowly trickled into films in the next 6 months.
No doubt, yeah, absolutely. And, right. And this is the first single from it, yeah, with Kendrick Lamar, as I said. It's called Never Catch Me. I can see the darkness in me and it's quite amazing. Like a death is my mystery and I want to taste it. Step aside of my mind and you'll find curiosity, animosity, high velocity. I can prophesize meditation. Reminisce on my wonder years and I wonder, yeah. Sentiments of my words ain't been so sincere. The sentiment to my nerve that I just persevere. The big thought of all the dark disappeared. To my faith, they say their head is real. Analyze my demise, I say I'm super anxious. Recognize I deprive this feeling, then embrace it. Vandalizing these walls only if they can talk. Conversations on contemplate to my dark thoughts. Looking down on my soul now. Tell me I'm in control now. Tell me I can live long and I can live wrong and I can live right and I can sing song and I can unite with you that I love, you that I like. Look at my life and tell me I fight. Is that final destination? Is that fonts of information? Is that fonts of inspiration? Is that crack the installation? Is that quantum dropping that fist pumping that bomb detonation? Please don't bomb my nation. And bomb me flew away.
Very cool music out of LA. That's Flying Lotus. If you'd have told me that was Outkast, I probably would have bought it.
Yeah, you're right. It's got a similar feel, isn't it?
Yeah, and very accessible compared to some of his, you know, quite bonkers solo productions.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, it's good sort of pop jazz with hip hop thrown in, isn't it?
Yeah, and definitely he's the nephew of Alice Coltrane.
That's right.
And you can kind of hear the jazz seeping through.
Absolutely, definitely.
Very nice. What have we got next?
All right, this is a pretty bizarre cover in a way because The Proclaimers, I'm Going to Be 500 Miles, one of our all-time favourites.
Wedding classic.
Absolutely.
You can't go wrong with that, Gene.
Totally perfect, yeah. Well, Kendra Morris, she's from New York, she's covered it. And featuring God Forbid on vocals as well. Right. I'm not totally familiar with, but I'll do some more research.
Good
but
name.
Yeah, and this is on the French label Naive, so it's got it's a proper release, you know. Yeah, I'd love to know what you think of this, actually.
When I wake up, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the one who wakes up next to you. And when I go out, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the one who goes along with you.
And if I get drunk, well, you know I'm gonna be the one who gets drunk next to you.
And if I hate her, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the one who's hatering to you.
I mean, it's definitely put a smile on my face.
It's good.
The production is fantastic. It's a really funky groove. It kind of makes me... It's sort of slightly unnecessary, but, you know, why not?
It's a good way of putting it, I suppose, yeah. I mean, she's kind of owned it, though, hasn't she? She's really made it her own.
She's made it her own. It's been a real journey for her.
Absolutely.
No, she has. Yeah, she has made it her own.
Yeah. But no, I like her. I think she's good. She had a single from earlier this year. It was great as well. I can't remember what it was, but... Yeah, she's crossing over. She's a pop star, you know.
I mean, that's a lot of artists. You know, if you don't get there, just try a sort of unexpected cover version, and suddenly everything falls into place. And also, that ties in very neatly with our referendum chat earlier.
That's why I chose it. You know,
that's obviously
Indie
ref fever has taken over Monaco House. Let's go with your last track.
Okay, well, this is this really reminds me of Sweden's Little Dragon. You know, I think they're fair to say, you know, Monaco favourites.
Oh yeah.
Sounds a lot like them, actually. But these guys are from San Francisco, and they really fuse all kinds of different styles in their music. It's another signing to True Thoughts, brand new signing from their first EP called Unravel, and this is The Fall.
That was The Session with The Fool, concluding that chat between Paul Noble and our new colleague Nick Luscombe, who has a new programme out, Monocle Presents. It airs at 1500 hours London time tomorrow on Wednesday. That's all we have time for, though, for today's episode of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Alessio Patilano and Roger Boyes, who talked us through the latest on Iraq, Russian sanctions and the looming Scottish referendum, and much more besides. My thanks to our producer, Alice Block, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Rebecca Unger, and our studio manager Bill Luty too. Next up after the headlines is Section D. I'll be back with Andrew Muller in a little under 2 hours time, 3 hours time, to bring you the Monocle Daily. So I hope you can join me for that. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.